Good morning, everybody. This particular lecture has to do with interviewing, and I'm going to be covering materials that are relevant to Chapter 6 and 7. There's also some materials that are important in this particular lecture for your interview assignment. Remember, what we're asking you to do is it's essentially identify somebody who is working in a field and in a particular position that you'd like to be doing in about 5 years. You're going to request a 15-minute informational interview with that person and then go in with a prepared list of questions to try and determine things like what kind of information did they wish they'd had before they started, what kind of classes do they wish they had before they found themselves in their particular position, information about the job so that you understand that it actually is something that you want to be doing in 5 years or so. But for the specifics today, we're going to be talking about interviewing, both employment interviewing and other types of interviewing. We're going to be talking about interviewing from both sides as well, not simply taking an interview, but also being the person who does the interview. So there'll be information that works on both sides of this. Because you may find yourself not only doing an employment interview, but you may be the one sent out by your company in order to interview people just like you 5 years from now in trying to get additional employees for your company. So let's begin. As with many of these lectures, we start with a definition. And in this case, there are lots of different definitions of interviews. If you're checking out and reading along with your PowerPoint slides, you'll see the first one there is planned face-to-face encounters in which one of the participants has a specific objective in mind. Well, geez, I'm just thinking this is not a very good definition of interviewing, because if you think about it, trying to get your one of your parents to give you the keys to the car for a Saturday night might be a face-to-face encounter in which you have a specific objective in mind. That doesn't make it necessarily an interview, so I'm thinking this is probably not a terrific kind of definition. The next one there must have been written by a communications specialist because, well, just the way it sounds. It says that an interview is a specialized, purposive, dyadic interaction that consists primarily of questions and answers. Again, it's an improvement. The term that you may not be familiar with there is dyadic, which essentially means it's two people being involved. But I like a lot of the information there. The third bullet that you see there says conversation with a purpose. Well, I mean, goodness, trying to pick somebody up in a bar is conversation with a purpose. That doesn't necessarily make it an interview. If you look at these three, however, you see, I think, the core of what makes interviewing, and that is there on the fourth bullet on the page. It talks about a sense of formality. There's something about interviews that are different from mere conversations. They are more formal, communicative interactions. Secondly, is some sense of strategy, that each side in an interview has things they want to accomplish. The employment interview has the company because wanting to get people hired, and obviously the people taking the interviews want to be their new employees. So there's a sense in which each side employs strategies about the way they answer questions, the kind of questions that they ask, and each side is working strategically to try and advance their interest during an interview. Finally, there's a sense that, of course, interviews are structured around questions and answers, that there are a series of questions that might be asked, and the way in which those answers proceed determine ultimately the functionality of the interview. So I think if you are looking for a definition of interviewing, if you just keep those three things in mind, formality, strategy, and that it consists primarily of questions and answers, we've got a pretty good sense of what we're talking about here. If you turn to the next slide, you'll see that there's a number of different types of interviews here, and I want to just touch briefly on all of them, because they all require different kinds of skills, they all require different kinds of preparation. Some of these you may be competent to do right now, others of these you probably need specialized training. But let me take a little time here to talk about this. The first one that you see on your list is counseling interviews. And increasingly, as more and more organizations, more and more businesses have become involved in employee assistance programs, in trying to help their employees with their personal lives, whether it's to overcome a weight problem or alcoholism or dealing with adult parents, you may find yourselves in an organization having one of your subordinates come in and begin to talk about their problems, and you may need to try and figure out what you need to know to help them, and you may find yourself essentially in the midst of a counseling interview. Again, I would caution any young manager from necessarily getting too deeply involved in these, because there are implications. If you give the wrong advice to your employee, if you give advice that they later act on that then gets them into trouble or causes bodily harm, you may find that your company and you individually might be liable for any damages that might happen as a result of these. Counseling is something that is done by trained professionals, and the most I think you want to do is to be able to refer your subordinate to the appropriately trained people in your organization who know how to do counseling interviews. Employment interviews are certainly something that all of you are going to be facing fairly soon as you go out and try and find that dream job. Again, if you think about it, these are communication interactions that are incredibly important in our lives. They are, it may in many ways determine whether or not you get that dream job or not. And they can be very stress-inducing. They can be, you can have completely wrong perceptions about what goes on in these kind of interviews. When I was first interviewing for my position here at Sac State, I was at the University of Pittsburgh, and what they had decided to do is they were kind of culling down the list, was they decided to do a series of phone interviews. And so here I am, you know, 2,500 miles away, trying to answer questions from a group of people on the other end of the phone that I'd never met, that I didn't know really who they were. And when we got done with the interview, I pretty much told my wife that I think we're going to have to cross Cal State Sacramento off the list, because I certainly didn't feel like I had any degree of sense that I knew how it was going. My sense was that it wasn't going very well. So maybe it's a testimony to the other people who were in the pool who weren't very good. But ultimately, I did get hired, even with this phone interview that scared the bejesus out of me. It's very important for you folks who are going out and maybe interviewing for your first big job to spend the time that it takes to prepare on those interviews. There are some very good bits of advice in Chapter 7 of your textbook. Just remember that though you do very few of these kinds of interviews, the people who are conducting the interviews may do hundreds or thousands of them over the course of their careers. They've had lots more practice in something like this than you have. And that means that you need to take the time to prepare so that you can kind of diminish that gap between their experience and your experience. It may mean that you need to go out and do your best to practice doing certain kinds of interviews, going through the Career Center and interviewing with companies that come to campus, even ones that you may only be kind of marginally interested in, just in order to kind of get yourself into that situation so that you know you won't freak out, so that you know you can go through an interview and put your best foot forward. We'll be talking more about employment interviews a little later. The next bullet on the slide there has to do with what are called exit interviews. And exit interviews are conducted when members of an organization, people who work for a particular business, leave that business. They are interviews that could be conducted by the supervisor, but they are more often conducted by people in human resources. And these kind of interviews are really have different kinds of purposes. One of the most obvious purposes to do an exit interview is to find out information from the person leaving the company. Why are they leaving? What do they have that? What's their impression of how the company is being run? Whether or not they had a positive experience with the company or not. Ultimately, it is your choice to be involved in these kind of exit interviews and whether or not you really kind of tell them everything you want to tell them. My guess is that even people in this class may have already gone through these kind of interviews, some of the folks out there. But the reason that organizations primarily do these kind of interviews is they're trying to gain information. After the sixth or seventh person leaves a particular department, it may be that the real problem in the department is not the individuals who are working there, but the person who's the supervisor. Excuse me. That supervisor may never be identified as the real source of the problems were it not for these kinds of exit interviews. So gaining information is one of the primary motives for doing them. A second, and a little bit more kind of devious or at least strategic idea for doing exit interviews, is that there's some research that suggests that if an organization, if a business does exit interviews, it may be an effective way to limit their liability in terms of court suits for wrongful termination. Sometimes when people are let go from organizations, they're very angry. And they want some kind of revenge. They want some kind of redress. Or in some cases, they just want people to listen to them. And it may be that simply by going through an exit interview, you're able to kind of bleed off some of that passion, some of that venom, and prevent them from going to talk to a lawyer. And remember that lawyers in these kinds of cases only get paid when there's some kind of settlement from the company. And if you're a small business, it would not take many of these wrongful termination lawsuits to put you in deep trouble. Because frankly, just having to be able to defend yourself against a wrongful termination lawsuit can be a very expensive proposition for a company. The result is, if you can do an exit interview where somebody finally sits down and listens to this disgruntled employee when they finally hear their side of the case, it may bleed off some of that passion that might result in a wrongful termination lawsuit. And so the idea here is that you use exit interviews not only to gain information, but also they can be a very effective tool at letting people kind of be heard so that they don't feel like they have to go be heard by a lawyer who's going to want to be paid by bringing suit against your company. A final and, you know, not very pleasant to think about purpose for exit interviews is that in some cases the people who are being terminated are not simply angry, but they're passionately violent. And the truth is that exit interviews, you might be able to identify those people who need to be barred from returning to the premises. That, you know, if they're making threats about, you know, their favorite gun, or if they're making threats about how they're going to do in their supervisors, that's a person that needs to be put on notice that they shouldn't return to the facility, that the security people for your company need to be notified that this person should not be allowed. And we hear these kinds of stories all the time over the course of a year. And it's one of the things that, frankly, you owe to your employees to protect their safety. An exit interview might be a perfectly appropriate place to identify people who might be violent or who are thinking about violence or who are so angry with their termination that they just need to be kept away from the facility for a while. So it's not pleasant to think about, but there are then three good reasons to do exit interviews for people leaving a company. You gain information, you decrease liability from lawsuits, and hopefully prevent violence. The fourth bullet on your list there has to do with what are called grievance interviews. This is an interview that you as a supervisor might have to undertake when you've got an employee who wants to bring a problem forward. They feel like they've been wronged and they feel like they need to be heard. The one thing that I would be very careful about if you're going to do these kind of grievance interviews is that you have to understand what is the legal environment in which you're doing those interviews. If you are covered by a collective bargaining agreement, that is, if there's a union at the facility, there may well be some very specific rules that you have to follow in entertaining people in a grievance interview situation. For instance, the question of whether or not these people can even have representation. Can they have a friend there? Can they have their lawyer there? Can they have their union steward there? All of those are questions that you very much need to know the answers to before you conduct a grievance interview. If you don't know the surrounding legal situation, if you have not been trained in handling grievance interviews, it's probably better to leave them for the human resources people who might be better prepared to conduct this kind of interview. Remember that if you violate somebody's due process, if you violate their rights under the collective bargaining agreement, whether or not they had a legitimate grievance to begin with in this situation, you may have created a legitimate grievance by denying them due process under the collective bargaining agreement. And so you want to be very careful with these kinds of things. The next kind of interview that you might see on in a company is called a performance appraisal interview. And my guess is that some of you may have already experienced this kind of interview, where perhaps once a year or once every 6 months or even every quarter you get called into your supervisor's office. You review your performance as an employee. You identify areas that you need improvement in. You identify areas that you're doing pretty well. And this interview is a chance for the supervisor and the subordinate to actually sit down and talk about that particular employee's performance. Obviously, what you're doing is trying to motivate people. You're trying to identify their flaws so that they can work on them and be conscious of them. And interestingly, there is some research that looks at performance appraisal interviews and tries to identify those factors which make them more or less effective. And two things have been identified in the research here that are kind of important. The first is that if you're truly using performance appraisal interviews to identify things that people need to work on and really improve their performance, it's really important that you do these kind of interviews more than once or twice a year. In fact, the research seems to suggest that unless you're doing performance appraisal interviews three or four times a year, they will not be as effective in changing employee behavior. And really, if that's what you're all about, if a performance appraisal interview is really designed to get people to improve, doing it once a year is kind of a waste of time, because what happens is the interview occurs, the employee kind of says, phew, that's over for another, 12 months, and I don't have to worry about those things. Somebody who is in a situation where performance appraisal interviews are happening every 3 or 4 months needs to be on constant guard to work on the things that they identified in the interview, and as a result, they tend to be more effective when they're done with that frequency to improve employee behavior, okay? The second thing that the research has identified about performance appraisal interviews has to do with the connection between those interviews and raises or increases in pay. Here's the situation. If there is too close a connection between that interview and the perceived case for a raise for that employee, what you're going to find is instead of focusing on employee performance and employee behavior, you're going to find that those particular interviews are really going to be used as kind of lobbying sessions for the employee to get better pay. I mean, I think that's understandable. If the employee thinks the results of the interview are going to be intimately connected with whether or not they get a raise, I think you'll find that people will spend their time lobbying that particular individual as to why they deserve that increase. It's not that the information from performance appraisal interviews shouldn't be used in calculating whether or not an employee gets a raise, but you should do your best as an employer to try and distance the interview from the actual awarding of the raise so that some time goes by, say a month or so, so that it's not as intimately connected. I think that you need to think about the timing of employee appraisal interviews as well as the frequency if you're going to use these to their best effect in a business setting. The next button on or bullet on the sheet there talks about persuasive interviews. And frankly, what we're really talking about here are sales calls. And there's an entire course in the business school that you may or may not have taken having to do with being an effective salesperson and how to close and all of that business. We're not going to be talking about that here, but there is some additional information in Chapter 6 and 7 that would be relevant to people doing those kind of interviews. The next to the last bullet on the sheet has to do with what are called group or panel interviews, and they're kind of opposites of the same thing. This is where you have interviews involving more than two people. In a group interview, you may have one person interviewing a group of folks, and that would be a situation where the number of interviewees outnumber the number of interviewers. So one person is attempting to interview a larger group. Those are almost always for informational purposes. It would be extremely awkward to have six or seven candidates for a job all be in the same room at the same time and try to have that group interviewed by a single person. The other part of this, panel interviews, You may have already experienced, in a lot of cases now, both in state government and in private business, you will see interviews conducted by more than one person. In fact, there would be a panel of folks asking questions of a single person. So, for instance, when I came to interview here at Sac State, I was interviewed by the hiring committee of my department, which consisted of three professors, all asking me questions. One of the interesting things that you find develops, that can develop in panel interviews, is a gender effect that can be quite disturbing to some of the people on the panel. Let me give you an example. You're being interviewed by a panel of folks, two males, one female. The female asks a question of you, and what can happen is you'll see the attention of that interviewee being directed, or the eye contact of that interviewee being directed to the males on the panel instead of the female who actually asked the question. That is obviously very disconfirming for that particular member of the panel, and it's to be avoided at all costs. And so let me give you a kind of simple remedy that really I think will help your chances in a panel interview, and that is, whoever asks you a question in a panel interview, you should begin your response with direct eye contact to the person who actually asked the question. But as you're speaking more and as you're trying to lay out some additional information in response to a question, you should then broaden your eye contact to the other members of the panel so that ultimately everybody is included. Don't simply respond to the single person who asked the question, nor should you only have direct eye contact with the person on the panel that you think has the highest status, or the person that you think, or that you may have even been told, is going to be the person who actually is making the decision for the hiring decision. Panel interviews really have a very different dynamic because you have different people asking you questions, and you need to be able to make those panel members feel like you're including everybody as you're responding to them. The final type of interview that we have on our sheet here is information gathering interviews. Those are the kinds of interviews that you're going to be doing in the interview assignment. Of course, online you'll find a written write-up of what it is you need to do in the interview assignment. Chapter 7 of your textbook also has some additional information for preparing for information gathering interviews, and I highly recommend reading that section before you go out to try to do the interview assignment. If you look at the textbook, there's a pretty clear sense that interviews have an opening, a middle, and an end. That is, they have a structure, not unlike the way speeches have structures, where they have introductions, bodies, and conclusions. Interviews have the same kind of situation, where there's an opening phase, there's a question and response phase, and then there's a closing phase. And I think you need to be mindful, whether you're taking an interview or giving an interview, of those particular elements. So let's just review for a second. In the opening phase, there are at least three things that you need to kind of take a sense of as you're proceeding with these interviews. One of the first things that needs to be done in the opening phase of an interview is there has to be a sense in which you establish rapport. That is, that there has to be some human connection between the two people who are involved in the interview. Whether that's done with a handshake, whether that's done with direct eye contact, perhaps a smile, it's very important that you spend that moment to establish that human connection. The second thing that your slide indicates is that you have to determine orientation. Now, let's be clear about this. We're not talking about anybody's sexual preference here. What we're really talking about is, what is the purpose of the interview? What part does it play in the selection process if it's an employment interview? The orientation really needs to be an understanding of how this interview fits into the larger picture. The third element under the opening phase, so we're still in the introductory period here of the interview, is to understand the motivation, and that's true on both sides. You need to get a sense from the person conducting the interview, if it's an employment interview, how desperate are they for people? How much you usually think in an interview situation that the company is the one holding all the cards. After all, they're the ones with the jobs. You're simply the job seeker, and you're completely at their mercy. But remember that employers hire people because they need good people to do things that are critical to the task of the business. And it may be that they've had difficulty hiring in this area. It may be that you're the person with exactly the kind of skills that they need, and therefore it may be that you actually have far more power in that interview than you likely might have concluded. And so think about, under understanding motivation, who has the power in the situation? Why are they out interviewing at this particular point in time? Is this simply restocking the corporate lineup so that they have the talented people that they need to go forward? Or is this filling perhaps a critical need in the company that they will not be able to succeed without filling? That might give you a very different kind of angle on this interview if, in fact, you have more power than you think you have. In the question response phase, obviously this is the body of the interview, we'll be talking in just a minute about the different kinds of questions, the format or structure of the questions that go on in this question response phase, and we'll save that for the next slide here in just a minute. Finally, like anything else, the concluding phase of the interview is important as well. And one of the things I want to talk about is post-interview follow-up. I think it's very important if somebody's taken the time to give you 15 minutes of their day to interview them, as they'll do for this interview assignment, that it's very important that you send them a thank you note. Now, maybe that note's only an email, or maybe that note is actually done on a formal piece of stationery, a thank you note. And please, if you're going to be interviewing a lot, you need to go out and purchase a box of appropriate thank you notes. You know, don't get a thank you note for a child's 6-year-old birthday party with like ducks and balloons on it. Get a thank you note that looks professional, and then write a personalized note to the person who interviewed you, thanking them for their time, and just giving them a sense that you know how to follow up in the situation. Post-interview follow-up means, you know, it's not over until the paperwork is done. And so I think that you need to be very conscious of responding to situations where you've gone in to do an interview, even a cursory interview, because you never know what stock those people are putting in who responds and who follows up. My wife was once involved in hiring an entire department of customer service personnel. She had a huge number of people that she talked to, and she paid very close attention to those people who did follow up, who sent a thank you note for an interview. Because remember, she was hiring customer service people. They need to understand process. They need to appreciate things like how you make human connections. And one of the ways she frankly determined whether or not people went on to the second round of interviews was whether or not they sent a thank you note. And I think in this case, that's entirely reasonable. So you never know exactly what they're going to be basing their decisions on, so it never hurts. You never want to burn a bridge. You always want to acknowledge their help in going through an interview. Let me move on now to types of interview questions. I said before that if you think about the body of an interview, we know that it consists primarily of questions and answers. But what we haven't really talked about are the kinds of questions that get asked in interviews. And I'm not talking about the specific content, I'm talking about the form in which those questions can occur. And so you see on the next slide there, 5 different kinds of questions. And we're going to talk about examples of each one. And the reason this is important is that there's a certain, relationship between questions and answers. And that the kind of answer that you give very much depends on the kind of question that gets asked. Tell me about your education asks a different kind of question than where did you graduate from college, right? Those are very different questions, not because they deal with different content, but because of the way they are phrased. And so you need to know a little bit about what those phrasings are, what those structures are, so that you can understand the nature of the appropriate response. So let's go to the first one. We're going to talk first about open questions. Open questions are ones which give the interviewee a maximum amount of freedom in responding to them. So if somebody asks you, tell me a little bit about your business experience, that's an incredible open question, which gives you the chance to talk. It puts the onus of responsibility on you for structuring your answer. Some people will say that one of the reasons they use open questions is it gives the interviewees just enough rope to hang themselves if that's what they're going to do. Open questions are ones in which you have to, as an interviewer, be willing to give those respondents a chance to kind of talk a little bit. They tend to, if you look at the patterns of response in interviews that are dominated by open questions, you'll probably see very little time actually taken up by the interviewer and more time being taken up by the interviewee. Hypothetical open questions are ones which are posed to put the interviewee in a particular situation. And of course, the classic hypothetical open question that I was actually asked for at a college interview when I was a senior in high school and trying to determine where I wanted to go to school. I went down to Bates College, which is a little college in central Maine. And they asked me actually in the interview for college, if I were stranded on a desert island, who would I want to be stranded with? That's a classic hypothetical open question. If then, right? If you were stranded on a desert island, then who would you want to be stranded with? It was a terribly difficult question because, you know, you didn't just want to say, oh, I'd like to be stranded with Pamela Anderson. There was the kind of wise-ass quotient that was part of it that I kind of edited in my head because I think in some ways the obvious answer to this question is a boat builder. If I was stranded on a desert island, I would like to be stranded with somebody who knows how to build boats. That would be, I think, a good answer. I don't even remember the answer that I finally gave, but it's a classic question. And sometimes hypothetical open questions find their way into interviews because what they, you know, they might do is they might ask you, here's a scenario, what would you do? Those are hypothetical open questions. In many ways, the opposite of an open question is a closed question. A closed question asks for a very limited, or in some cases, just a yes or no answer. So a classic closed question is, have you ever been convicted of a felony? That's pretty much a yes or no. They're not looking for a big, long explanation. They're simply asking whether or not you've ever been convicted of a felony. And at some level, you ought to be able to simply answer that yes, no. If you think about closed questions in an interview, closed questions used to an extreme are going to feature more talking by the interviewer than the interviewee. And it really comes down to how much ground do you need to cover, how much information do you need to gather, and probably a good interviewer does not use one or the other to an exclusion, right? That you would want to mix in open and closed questions because you want to keep control of the interview, but at the same time, you don't want to be the one doing all the talking. You want to feature the interviewee at some point as well. The last three that you see on the list here are types of questions that could be sprinkled in to an interview situation. Probing questions are ones that can be used, for instance, in follow-up of a closed question to ask for a little more information. So where did you go to school? And you respond, I went to Sacramento State. The interviewer might use a probing question at that point to follow up and say, oh, Sac State, now tell me what you did at the business school and tell me what kinds of courses you took while you were there. That's a probing question because it's given as a follow-up, and it should be a signal to the interviewee that this person is looking for a little more than the information that you gave in the closed question. So they're asking for additional information. A loaded question is one that you should answer with very, very much kind of patience and being really, really careful. Here's an example of a loaded question that's kind of the classic example that people use. Have you stopped beating your wife yet? Think about that. Have you stopped beating your wife yet? Either way you respond to that, you're going to be pegged as a wife beater. Yes, I've stopped beating my wife. Oh, that's nice. Or no, I haven't stopped beating my wife. Again, that's a very tough question to answer because it makes an assumption that I hope in this case is flawed, right? If you're not a wife beater, how is it that you answer a loaded question? I think at that point, whenever anybody, let's say somebody looks at your resume and says, well, I see that you seem to be a job hopper. Tell me about that. Well, yes, I'm a job hopper. I always look for the next best situation. Or, no, I'm not a job hopper, even though I used to be. I think you have to question the underlying assumption in a loaded question in order to get out of it. So you don't buy into the, yes, I've stopped beating my wife, or no, I haven't stopped beating my wife, and instead get to the underlying assumption. A final kind of question that shows up in interviews is called a leading question. And it, interestingly enough, it's one that is asked in which the answer is kind of implied in the question itself. So, for instance, if you were interviewing up at Intel and you hear a question like this, here at Intel, we very much approve of and try to implement collaborative decision-making in all of our team projects. Can you tell me what kind of decision-making you like to use in small groups? Well, gee, they pretty much just told you the right answer is collaborative decision-making. If you respond by saying, no, I'm pretty much an authoritarian leader, and so I like to railroad the group that I'm working with in order to get them to do exactly what I want them to do, that's wrong in so many ways, because they've pretty much implied to you that the correct answer is collaborative decision-making. So you want to hear to see if there are hints in questions that people ask. They don't always ask leading questions because they want to give you a hint, but sometimes those hints are there. So I think it really pays to think about the different structures of questions that you might be able to hear in interviews, because they do imply that a particular kind of answer is appropriate. If you give a long, rambly answer to a closed question, they're going to think that you're not a competent communicator, because they've given you a very specific kind of structure and you've not responded well to it. If they give you an open question and you don't take the opportunity to answer it at length, or at least with a little elaboration, then they're not going to think that you're a competent communicator. So it's important that you understand these various kinds of questions and the kind, more importantly, the kind of answers that they imply. If you look at the next slide, there's a pretty clear sense that there are legal issues that surround all kinds of interviews. And in fact, in the area of employment interviews, there is federal law that covers the kinds of questions that are appropriate and the kinds of questions that are not. So if you see the Equal Employment Opportunity Laws cover companies that have more than 15 employees, more than $50,000 in federal contracts, or if they engage in interstate commerce. So if your company sells products across state lines, it's likely that they need to be bound by the Equal Employment Opportunity Laws that say that there are some things that are simply inappropriate to ask in a job interview. A question like, are you married, is frankly none of the business of the people doing the interview. And they may not realize that, or maybe they do, but ultimately what the guideline says, and you'll see the last bullet there, BFOQ stands for bona fide occupational qualifications. That means that they really can only ask you questions that bear some relationship to the requirements for the job. So if somebody asks you in the middle of a job interview, how much can you bench press? If you're an administrative assistant and that's what you're applying for, it seems unlikely that that's a bona fide occupational qualification, and instead they're asking about, how much weight can you lift? On the contrary, if you're interviewing with UPS and you're going to be working the overnight shift slinging packages, it seems to me whether or not you can consistently lift 45 or 60 pounds might be an entirely relevant kind of occupational qualification. When I used to teach back in Boston at Emerson College, I actually had a student who financed her way through college through a modeling career. And it wasn't just a modeling career where, she would model for, Sunday circulars or whatever, but she was a body part model. And in fact, the body part that she used to model the best was her, shall we say, behind, her butt. She made her way through school by being a somebody who modeled the bottoms of bikini bathing suits or underwear for catalogs. And so, you know, across Sears catalogs across the country, there may be, well, pictures of a person's butt. This person's butt, which is kind of an interesting way to kind of finance your school. But here's the thing. If you go into a regular interview and somebody asks you for your portfolio of pictures of your behind, if you're there for an accounting job, that's probably not a legal question. However, for this particular woman and the kind of jobs that she was seeking, she used to actually carry around a portfolio of pictures of her behind, because that was a bona fide occupational qualification for the particular jobs that she was interviewing for. So it's very situational. It's not always easy to identify for sure what is an illegal question and what is a legal question. But there are times when you have to, you know, kind of listen very carefully. It is obviously can be a bona fide occupational qualification for somebody to ask how fast can you type if the job that you're applying for requires a lot of typing. However, if it's a management position and they only ask the female applicants how fast can you type and they don't ask the male applicants that question, you may be in a situation where they're actually engaging in illegal gender discrimination because they're only asking the women whether or not they can type very fast. Also listen for questions that on their surface may seem okay, but and that you'd be willing to give an answer to, but in doing so, you might actually be giving up information that you don't have a requirement to give up. So, for instance, imagine somebody asks you in an interview, who will care for your kids while you're at work? Well, the truth is that's an illegal question. It's illegal in a couple of different ways, but most importantly, it's illegal because employers are not required allowed to ask you whether or not you even have kids. And frankly, it's not really their business whether or not you have kids and how it is you care for them while you're on the job. You could respond to that and say, well, I actually hang them on hooks in my front closet while I'm at work, so you shouldn't worry. But obviously, there's something underlying this question. When they ask, you know, who's going to be caring for your kids while you're at work, there's that fear that kind of motivates a question like that, that your daily life and your family life is going to interfere with what's going on at work. And so we're going to actually move to the next question, the next slide, which talks about dealing with illegal questions. Because if you do enough interviews, you're almost always going to be put in a situation at some point, either because of the recklessness of the interviewer or because of the ignorance of the interviewer, where you're going to confront illegal questions. And how you respond to those illegal questions is really a rather complex thing. You don't, I think, really want to, you know, jump up and say, aha, it's an illegal question. And I'm not going to respond to that. That's kind of awkward, and it may have blown your chance for the job. So let me begin and ask you a couple of questions as we talk about dealing with illegal questions. The first is, you know, if somebody asks you a question that you believe to be illegal, you want to ask yourself the question, how badly do you want this job? And I say that kind of only slightly tongue-in-cheek, because the truth is, it may well dictate how you respond to this person. If this is a job you really want, I'm not saying that you should put up with an illegal question, but it may mean that you respond to it in a different way than if you don't really want this job. So I think the first response that you want to make outwardly to an illegal question is to ask the person doing the interview for a clarification of the question, and more specifically, how it is that the information they're asking for connects to the job. Because the truth is, you may not always know what the full range of requirements are for a particular job when you walk into an interview. And by asking that question, you're essentially asking them to identify what they've asked about is a BFOQ, that it's a bona fide occupational qualification, that it has a legitimate connection to the job that you might be hired for. It also helps them to note that if they've stepped over a line you're kind of calling them on it. You're identifying that this is a potentially difficult area, and if they can't make a connection between what they've asked about and ultimately, you know, what the job is about, they should kind of withdraw the question and they should step back, okay? Another possible way to respond to a difficult question, I like to call kind of sidestep and neutralize. So, for instance, in the previous example I gave where they ask a question, who's going to be caring for your children while you're at work, rather than respond to that directly, you need to really listen for the fear behind that question, which is that somehow your family life is going to, you know, damage your ability to do your job. Really what they're asking about is whether or not you're going to be late, whether or not your child care issues are unstable enough to make you an unreliable employee. And I think the appropriate response there is not that, you know, my grandmother lives at home with us and is going to be taking care of the children while I'm at work. Because remember, that's really none of your employer's business. I think the appropriate response there is sidestep and neutralize, which means, well, if you have concerns, I would tell the employer, if you have concerns about my reliability as an employee, I encourage you to check with the supervisor from my previous job, and I'm sure that person will tell you that I was very reliable, I was always on time, I took very few sick leave days, and the result was I think I can do the job for you. That, again, allows them to get the sense that you've identified this as an area that is potentially problematic, it could be illegal, and that you've heard the fear that generated that question, and you've responded to that concern more directly rather than actually answered the question. Okay. A final way to deal with these kind of illegal questions is to ask yourself whether or not this is a really gross violation. Ladies in the class, for instance, unless this is a modeling job, it's probably an illegal question to ask you for your body measurements, right? Unless you have to wear a uniform, that's part of the job, it's none of their business what your measurements are, and they may well be stepping dramatically over the line if they ask you about that. If it's a gross violation of the law, if they've really stepped over or repeatedly stepped over the line in terms of asking for illegal information, I think you probably want to contact that company. Now, you're right, this is probably going to blow any chance you have for getting a job with these folks. But frankly, if they have representatives who are out running around asking people questions that are clearly illegal, do you really want to work for these people anyway? I mean, my guess is they've pretty much identified themselves as an employer that doesn't really care about the future of the company because they're really putting themselves at risk. There have been suits against companies who've continually asked their interviewees questions that are illegal. If this happens within a university setting, if, for instance, you're going through the Career Center and the people who are here from a particular organization are not able to identify why the information they're asking for is, in fact, BFOQ, you may want to report it to the people who run the Career Center so that they can warn the representatives from that company or call the company and let them know that the person that they've sent over to interview students is asking questions that are potentially illegal. And they'll probably pull that person back into the organization because they don't want to get the reputation of sending out people who are not professional. Okay, so it's not easy to deal with the illegal questions, and it is that something that I think gives you pause. You do want to think about how badly you want that job. If this is just a recreational interview, you may be more aggressive in confronting the person who's asked the illegal question, right? But if you do really want the job, you may have to be a little more circumspect. You may have to be a little more subtle in signaling to the interviewer that they're asking for information that's potentially, not something that they should be knowing about. And as a result, kind of signal your professionalism and make them kind of pause a little bit and think about what it is they're asking people. We have two more slides to go on this particular session, and I want to spend a moment talking about preparing for employment selection interviews. Obviously, when you folks graduate and you're out there kind of looking for a chance to make your way in the world, it's an incredibly important thing that you do solid preparation in anticipation of employment selection interviews. You may only have one shot at your dream job. You may only have one shot where you get on with the company that you've always wanted to work for. And these are incredibly important communication situations, situations where you've really got to put your best foot forward, and you want to give yourself that best shot. And the only way you can really do it is to spend some time preparing. What are the things you want to do? Well, some of the things are suggested in Chapter 7 of your book, and you certainly want to review those. But here are some that I'm suggesting. One is to prepare your review your own strengths and weaknesses. Know what you want to establish as the things that you can do for that particular company. And again, it is situational. It is that particular company. You also want to know that if you've got particular weaknesses, maybe you have a low GPA, maybe you didn't do well in your accounting classes, maybe you haven't actually had a full-time job in the area or with the kind of in the field that you're actually interviewing in. All of those are questions that may bring to mind you may have to anticipate the interviewer kind of getting at that. So explain to me why you have a 2.2 GPA and that I should hire you over somebody who has a 3.75. That's a question that ultimately you may be confronted with if you have an unusually low GPA as you graduate from college. So review your strengths and weaknesses, because there are times when you can turn your weaknesses into strengths. For instance, my wife is involved in the mortgage industry, and over a course of years, at some point, I think she had had 5 different jobs in 4 years. And it certainly looks like there's a lot of instability on her resume. It certainly looked like she was job hopping a bit. But really what was at work was, this was a period in our lives where we moved from Boston to Pittsburgh, where I was going to get my PhD. And she worked for a couple of companies that ultimately went out of business. And in fact, what she would do when people asked her about the large number of different places that she worked over a relatively short period of time, she would actually turn that into a strength by saying, look, I've worked in different phases of the mortgage industry. I've been an underwriter. I've been a processor. I've worked in the secondary market. I've been a loan officer outselling retail mortgages. I've also worked as a wholesale mortgage broker. The result is she's able to demonstrate that these various different jobs that she's had with different companies, which the interviewer might have originally interpreted as a weakness, she was able to sell it to them as a strength. So she really wanted people to ask that kind of question, because it turned out to be a real positive for her. Make sure that you actually practice difficult questions. If you think, let's say you have a hole on your resume of 18 months, and that's because you were actually the guest of the state at a correctional facility. If you've been out of circulation for 18 months, they're going to want to ask you about that. You've got to have a response that doesn't have you stuttering, that doesn't have you kind of searching for an answer. You want to actually be able to practice out loud, not just in your head, not simply running these things over in your mind, but you want to actually practice answering those difficult questions. That's why mock interviews are a really good thing to do. Make sure that you research the company that you're actually interviewing for. If you can get the information about who the interviewer is, it's important that you try and get some information on them as well. An interview, like a public speech, is really about audience analysis. In the same way that we say that a speech is only really good if it's well adapted to its audience, an interview is, in this kind of situation, is only going to be successful if you've been able to adapt to the particular situation and the particular person or organization that you're interviewing with. So spend the time to do a little research. These days with the internet, these days with all the tools that you folks have available to you over in the library and online, it's pretty easy. I mean, go to a company's website and learn a little bit more about them. Learn when they were founded. Learn what was the goal of the early company. Figure out what makes a particular company tick. Because if you can adapt to those kinds of values or virtues, you're going to have an interview where they really take you seriously. Finally, I think it's really important that you think about anticipating requests that might be made during an interview. Obviously, if you're going into a company for a full day of interviews where you might be interviewed first by your potential supervisor, second by people in human resources, third by a panel of supervisors, or even the CEO of the company, you need to be able to anticipate that you need multiple copies of your resume. If you have a very long resume, you may want to consider having two different versions, one that they can simply look at on a single page that has all the highlights, and one that's really a more complete view. In academia, we have resumes that are called curriculum vitae that show things like what professional organizations we're involved in, what kind of classes have we taught, what have been our publications, where do we get our education, what kind of courses are we prepared to teach. And some academic vitas can run 20 or 30 or 40 pages. However, if you're sitting down in an interview situation, somebody's not going to read all 20 or 30 pages right at that moment, and that's why it's really important to have a single page that kind of highlights everything that you're about, so that somebody in that kind of situation can take a quick glance down and see exactly what you need. You can organize interviews resumes. You can organize resumes chronologically or by skill set, right? I mean, these are some obvious things that when you take your business communication class, you'll be thinking about. You might want to consider having a resume that works both ways, right? That you have one kind of version of your resume that's done chronologically so that people can see your employment history. You might want to have a different resume organized by skill set so that you can highlight what it is you can do for a company. It emphasizes your skills rather than your employment history. Again, different situations might require different kinds of resumes, but have extra copies along with you when you go out for an employment interview. Final one down there is drug tests, and frankly, this is not something to just laugh about. It's not something to take lightly. I would add to drug tests also credit reports, because increasingly companies are running credit reports on their potential employees to get a sense of whether or not they're reliable, whether or not they pay their bills, because some companies view that as a very important bit of information to decide whether or not they're going to offer somebody a job. So, for instance, you would want to make sure that your credit report is fairly clean. Work with a credit counselor or work with somebody who knows something about credit reports to get misinformation removed, to make sure that you get your bills paid on time and that your credit scores are reasonable. In the area of drug testing, though we don't do this a lot anymore simply with candidates for jobs, but for instance, between the time that you may be offered a job, it may be conditional on taking and passing a drug test. And again, this is one of those situations where you need to know whatever your recreational lifestyle is, whether or not it's going to impact your employment situation. I'm trying to be kind of honest here that you ought to learn a little bit about the kind of test that they use and whether or not you're likely to run afoul of it, because you don't want to put all this time and effort into an interview. You don't want to put all this time and effort into a job search only to be foiled by some recreational drug use on a weekend that eliminates you from the possibility of getting into this particular employment area. Read about the kind of test that the company wants you to have. Is it a hair test? Is it a urine test? Is it a blood test? Because different tests have different reliability rates. They go back different rates of time. Obviously, a blood test is a little more immediate. A hair test can actually have a history. This might be one of those days to actually go bald. And be serious about whether or not the people you hang around with on weekends are going to be making more difficult your chance of getting the job that you really want. So learn something about drug testing before you go in. Don't be surprised about what it is they're asking for. And I'm not asking you to engage in any nefarious kinds of things. I'm not asking you to go out and buy urine on the internet so that you can switch your urine for somebody else's urine. But too many people simply get surprised. And if you have been taking cold medicine, if you have been eating an unusual number of poppy seed bagels, you want to make sure that that all gets revealed to the folks who are giving you the drug test, because there can be false positives. Certain things that you take for cold medicine, for instance, may show up as screens for barbiturates in drug tests. Poppy seeds may be read, at least apocryphally, as opiates. You have to eat, though, a busload of poppy seed bagels for it to actually test positive in a drug test for opiates. But nonetheless, these are things to be a little concerned about. The final slide and the final point I want to talk about today is we've talked a little bit about the things that can make interviews successful. I want to end by talking with a study that looked at the question of why interviews failed. This study was conducted at Northwestern University just outside of Chicago, Illinois. And what they actually did is they surveyed the employers who came into Northwestern to do interviews with Northwestern seniors to get a sense of when interviews went poorly, what were the causes of, what were the reasons why those interviews seemed to fail. And the truth is, if you look at this list here, if you look at the groupings of the reasons why people's interviews failed, almost all of them can be traced back to your communication behavior. So it's very important that we talk about this so that you know what it is you're doing that might be sending the wrong signal in an interview situation. The first reason for problems in interviews, the Northwestern study characterized as style problems. These were situations where, for instance, people did not dress appropriately. And again, I'm not saying that everybody, you know, every guy has to wear a blue suit and every woman has to wear a white blouse and a conservative skirt into an interview. But think about who you're interviewing with and make sure that you dress appropriately. There are some organizations that if you wore a suit to the interview, they'd think you were weird and that you wouldn't fit in with the kind of more relaxed corporate lifestyle that they have. There are other situations where if you walked into an interview in simply a pair of chinos and a button-down shirt, that might not be formal enough. So you have to look at the organization and figure out what's appropriate. It's almost never a problem to be a little too formal. Being even a little too casual may get you into trouble. The next thing is limp handshake. Oh, my goodness. You wouldn't think that this was a real issue, but I have to tell you, we went through a hiring situation in my own department about 15 years ago, and we had a guy in interviewing for a position, and I have to tell you, every time we shook hands with this guy, it was like, you know, the limp fish handshake. It was just terrible. And so here are communication professors who should be talking about whether or not this particular candidate has the kind of resume, has the kind of research interests, has the kind of abilities coming from a particular doctoral program to succeed as a faculty member. And man, about the only thing we could talk about was what a limp fish handshake this guy had. You don't think it's important, but it's part of that establishing rapport. Ladies, if you've been taught to do a little kind of sideways, very limp handshake, you need to think about practicing with a male friend to do a straight-on, firm handshake. And guys, let's be careful out there, right? If you are a big, strong guy and you grab a woman's hand, it is not appropriate to crush her knuckles together. You're not proving anything what a tough guy you are. Just a firm handshake that's equally firm to the person that you're shaking hands with is important. Another thing that the companies talked about in this Northwestern study was the lack of eye contact. Again, whatever culture you come from, in some cultures, of course, a lack of eye contact is read as a sign of respect. But frankly, this is one of those deals where when in Rome, do like the Romans. Here in North America, we take direct eye contact as a sign of respect. And I think most of the people that you will interview with will as well. So you want to think about how it's important to look people directly in the eye when you kind of first meet them. And during the interview, don't have your focus off in space somewhere. Don't continue to look down in your lap. Look directly at the interviewer. A second set of problems for failed interviews at the Northwestern study had to do with the attitude problems. And these were things like a sense that the candidate had a superiority complex, that they didn't want to start at the bottom or enter the managerial trainee program. They thought they were so great that they could just come in and start at the top. And obviously, you want to consider the way in which you're presenting yourself in this interview, that you have to be, even if you are a fabulously well-credentialed kind of candidate for a particular job, whether you think you could do this job in you know, your sleep, you have to present yourself to them with a certain amount of modesty and a certain amount of grace, and a superiority complex kind of violates all kinds of those things. Thinking about the way in which humor works in interviews is important, too. All I have to tell you is, you know, if the interviewer makes a joke or if the interviewer says something amusing, make sure you smile and or laugh at it. And I'm not saying you got to roll around on the floor, but some people fail interviews because the interviewer gets the sense that this person was completely without a sense of humor. And if they don't have a sense of humor, they doubt whether or not you're going to get along with the rest of the employees in their office or in their company. And the result is you want to think about, you know, being yourself, about smiling, about responding. And I'm not saying you go in telling jokes. I'm saying simply that you respond to the humor that exists in the situation. Most directly, and what the study found is the most significant problems for people failing in interviews, they grouped as communication problems, an inability to express oneself clearly. This is where practice really takes over. Be able to answer the tough questions, be able to answer the question well in a reasonably practiced way, why it is you have qualifications for this job. Think about the obvious questions that show up again and again in interview selection, in employment selection interviews. What attracted you to this job? What are your strengths and weaknesses? What can you offer this company? Those are questions that you need to have practiced answers on to the point where you sound natural. Excessive nervousness. The truth is, as we talked about stage fright for public speeches, people get as much or even more nervous in interview situations because, frankly, there's a lot more at stake if you think about it. You know, when you're doing your informative speech, you're only talking about a particular grade in a particular class in an entire college career. When you're talking about the Intel interview that you really, really have wanted to take for a long time and now you have your chance, there's a lot more at stake at that situation, and as a result, the chance of being nervous, the chance of demonstrating that nervousness, really interfering with your ability to interview well, is a concern. Fortunately, the same things that we talk about in getting people more comfortable in speaking situations also work in interview situations as well. Again, it may be that you want to take practice interviews just to decrease your level of stress so that you get when you get to the interviews you really want to do well in, you've had some practice there. You haven't put it off. Make sure that in an interview you don't condemn past employers. I believe that in the Greek community, in the world of sororities and fraternities, they call this bad rush, right? You're not supposed to encourage new people to join your fraternity or sorority by speaking ill of the other fraternities and sororities. And the truth is the same for employers. An employer who hears somebody crabbing and complaining and whining about a previous employer is going to wonder whether or not you're going to be the difficult, high-maintenance person that you seem like in front of them and whether or not they want to hire you. Have clear explanations for why you've left previous employers. You don't need to kind of drag out all of the bloody details, but you do have to have a competent explanation. But keep the actual condemnation of past employers to a minimum. Finally, remember that as you present yourself on any resume, you ought to be able to explain anything that's on it. If you can't, I think that your employer or the interviewer is certainly going to have pause and say, wow, does this person even really know, you know, are these things even true? They can't even explain why there's this gap, or they can't explain what it is they actually did in a particular situation. I think it's really important that people maintain a sense of honor and integrity on their resumes, that they don't exaggerate. It's okay to put yourself in a good light, but when you start making things up, I think you go way past that situation. And it's going to be teased out in an interview, and it almost always ends badly for both the candidate and the company. So we've talked a little bit about some of the things that folks need to do to prepare for the interview assignment in class. We've talked about some of those things that I think will help you when you go out and do interviews or when you go out and do employment selection interviews for your favorite job. Remember that the interview assignment that we've designed is to really to give you a chance to interact with somebody who's doing the job that you really want to do in 5 years or so. You may find that, I mean, we've had people who have had offers of internships with the person that they ended up interviewing. We've had a couple of instances over the last 10 years where people have actually gotten job offers from the people that they've interviewed at the time of the interview. They were so impressed with the professionalism, with the preparation of the person doing the interview in these little interview assignments that they actually offered them jobs. Now, I'm not making any promises out there. I'm not giving you any guarantees. But interacting with somebody professionally is a very important thing. Make sure that you do the follow-up paperwork, that you send the thank you note. Remember that you're also asking these people for a copy of their business card, because that needs to be included with the report of the interview assignment that goes to your GAs. And ultimately, I think you're going to find this to be a very positive experience. It can be a little intimidating. It can be a little nerve-wracking. But we want you out there interviewing people that you don't know so that you all have a similar kind of experience, and take the chance to get out there and stretch and see what is out there on the horizons, because I think that you're going to find it to be a very valuable experience. Okay, this is the end of the interview assignment. Remember, it deals with Chapter 6 and 7 in your textbook. Thanks very much.